Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
If you can hear my voice, but you can't see me, I am in the penguin exhibit, in the water, directly across from the glass doors where you first entered the aquarium this morning.
That's the delightful sound we were greeted with when we went to the New England Aquarium yesterday. We were there to meet Aquarium CEO Nigella Hilgarth.
So the penguins are my favorites because I used to work on them.
We were surrounded by kids and parents, visitors from around the world, all craning their necks over the glass walls of the penguin enclosure, trying to get a glimpse of the aquarium's tuxedoed stars.
Our timing's perfect, isn't it? Maybe a little too perfect.
African penguins, which are in this section of the exhibit. Little blue penguins over in that section of the exhibit.
So we moved to a quieter corner of the aquarium on a ramp bathed in the blue light of the aquarium's giant ocean tank. Nigella Hilgarth has been the president and CEO of the New England Aquarium since May of 2014. In that time, the former penguin scientist has faced some pointed criticism about how she's positioned the New England Aquarium into an advocacy role rather than strictly education and research. For example, Hilgarth supports legislation that seeks to ban the sale of shark fins and has pushed for the creation of a marine monument in portions of the Gulf of Maine. So we talked about the challenges of moving from research to advocacy with Hilgarth, but first we had to start with the penguins.
Well, we came in through the front doors here. You said that the penguins were your favorite. Can you tell us why?
Yes, they are my favorites. And it's because I used to study them. I used to be a zoologist, and I've done research on penguins in the more sort of warmer parts of the world. So I studied penguins in the Galapagos and in Peru, and looked at the impacts of stress on penguins.
And I'm going to guess that too much stress is bad for penguins, just as it's bad for humans.
That's a very good guess, yes. We actually happened to be there in an El Nino year, and then came back the next year, and found that, you know, lack of food when the water heats up and the fish go away is obviously very stressful for these birds. They don't have enough to eat. And then they recovered very quickly when the fish came back.
Well, good. So they're resilient then, at least.
They tend to bounce back. They are resilient.
Well, let's go back in time a little bit, because we'd love to hear your story about what spawned your love of the natural world and of science. You grew up in Ireland, right?
I grew up deep in the Irish countryside in Tipperary, and I was very lucky. We grew up in front of a large lake, lots of woods, and so nature was all around me. So that I think that's what really sparked my interest.
So can you tell us a story? I mean, when we were doing our preparation for this, I just love the story about your close encounter with an otter.
Well, that really was a, you know, life-changing event for me, I think, because when you have a real encounter with another animal, when you're looking into its eyes, that can be life-changing. I'm not sure if it was for the otter, but it certainly was for me. So I was in a little blind that I had made of branches quite close to the lake, not far from the house. And I was looking at birds on the lake. And then suddenly I looked down, and this very young otter, probably a few months old, was crossing in front of the blind, just at, almost at my feet. And it either smelt me or saw me, and it looked up. And I looked down, we both stopped moving and just stared at each other for a long time. And it was, to me as a child, it seemed like having a conversation. And then eventually the otter moved on and I was thrilled. It was a moment that I never forgot.
How old were you?
I was about 8 or 9, I think.
Wow.
At the time.
And so you had a capacity for observation and stillness at that young age.
Well, I suppose, put it that way, yes, I guess I did. I realized very early on that was the only way that I could really observe animals.
Yeah. Well, before we talk a little bit more about how you went from that to your career in science, can we just take a little detour? Because I have to ask you about your father. I was trying to think of a fun but respectful way of saying this. He was something of a meddler himself. I mean, a spy for Great Britain during the Second World War, is that true?
That is true, actually, yes. he was in intelligence during the Second World War. In fact, even before that, he was naval attaché in Madrid and in charge of British intelligence in that area.
Looking back now, was there any evidence of the influence of his experiences that sort of bled into your childhood in terms of how he helped you look at the world or the opportunities that he gave to you?
I think he'd been through a lot. He fought in the First World War as well, the Spanish Civil War, and then the Second World War. And so I knew him as somebody who was really retired, writing books, and taking enormous value in the little things in life. So it wasn't his actual being a spy that impacted me. It was how he valued peace and how he valued the world.
Uh-huh. Interesting. But you didn't follow a sort of a conventional path into being a world-traveling scientific researcher, though, right? I mean, because I read that you did eventually go to Oxford University, but not until you were in your 20s?
That's true, actually, yes. I always knew I wanted to work with animals. Apparently, I marched around the house, age 5, saying, I'm an animal lover, and to me, it's a very logical path, but I think I was brought up at a time and in a society where women didn't necessarily go to university. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s that somebody said to me, you know, you're so passionate about animals and science, you really do need to go to university. And I hadn't realized that I was intelligent enough to go to university. I'm quite dyslexic. And though I've really got over that, but at the time, I didn't realize that that's one of the reasons I hadn't flourished in academia.
Who told you? Well, I mean, who was the person who told you that you should go to university?
Oh, that was a wonderful woman, Janet Keir, who worked at the place where I was working at the Wildfowl and Wetland Trust, which was a lovely place in southern England, and I was looking after the birds and having a wonderful time. And she said, you know, I think you should get a degree, you should take this seriously. So she was, you know how you have mentors in life? She was one of those special people who helped to push me towards that.
Oh, wow. So it's never been easy for women in science. And I mean, what was it like for you? Because when you went to Oxford, you were obviously a woman, but you were also older than sort of other entering students might have been. So what was that like?
I was 27. I was called a mature student. but I was lucky. I went to Somerville College, which then was still all women. It's co-ed now. And I had another wonderful mentor there, Marion Dawkins, who she encouraged women to go into science and to realize that they could be just as good as anyone else. She had a very distinguished career herself.
Now, did you say her name was Marion Dawkins?
Yes.
Related to Richard Dawkins?
She was married to Richard at the time.
Okay.
Yes.
So you have had a tremendous career doing, I mean, we talked about your penguin research. What prompted you to make the transition from doing scientific research in the field to where you find yourself now, more, you know, running a big institution like the New England Aquarium? Why did you make that transition?
Well, I think a sort of thread running through this for me was what was beginning to happen to the environment. And, you know, I'm an evolutionary biologist by training, and going to all these different places, began to see habitat degradation, smuggling of rare species, all these things that were a concern to me, and I felt that the public was not hearing about this. And so that I got very worried about the future of our planet, and the disconnect between people who were not studying these things and what was happening. And so I got more and more interested in talking to the public.
That gets us to what you hope for the New England Aquarium now, because, I mean, what do you see as sort of the primary mission for the New England Aquarium, given the state of our oceans today?
I think it's really essential that the visitors who come here need to have a good time, but at the same time begin to get a sense of what the ocean issues are and what we need to do to actually make some of these things better in the ocean. Ocean optimism, I like to call it.
Yeah. I mean, in our conversation so far, I've definitely heard that this sense of you being personally connected to the environment is a very animating force in your life, and trying to bring that sense of connection, encourage that same sense of connection for people who visit, is very a meaningful mission to you. But there's also, there comes some controversy in the question of how far should the aquarium go in, you know, its mission to create that connection, because there are some people who say that maybe under your leadership they feel that the aquarium is being taking on too much of an advocacy role.
Well, you know, I say to that, the aquarium has actually always taken on an advocacy role. I think we just may be a little louder about it. The aquarium has testified in Congress about Stillwagon Bank, for example. But I liken it to, well, it's not an exact analogy, but if you think of an art museum standing by and not saying anything while great works of art are being destroyed, deliberately or not, they're going to speak up and say something. And so I think the aquarium has always done that, and I'm continuing that. But what we're doing is shaping that in hopefully a very constructive and solution-oriented way.
So before we wrap up, since we are here at the aquarium, it's one of my favorite sites.
Oh, I know. Sea turtles are really something, aren't they?
They're amazing. What a beauty. Okay, you're not allowed to pick one of the charismatic animals here, not the penguins or the sea turtles, but one of your other favorite animals that we can see at the aquarium.
Well, I actually love the monkfish. I don't know if you're familiar with the monkfish. She's rather ugly. She's very flat. She once a year lays the most beautiful purple veil of eggs. It's thousands and thousands of eggs, knitted together like a very gossamer purple veil. It's one of the most extraordinary and beautiful experiences. So I'd have to say that's one of my favorites.
And 5 or 10 years from now, what would you like to see for the New England Aquarium? What's your vision?
My vision is hopefully the same energy that you hear today. I think now when people leave, about 40% say they want to do something to help the oceans. I'd like to double that. I'd like to have to bring the ocean in here more and to take people out to the ocean. To me, success is if they actually want to go spend time on the real thing.
Well, thank you so much for having us over at the aquarium, and best of luck to you in helping all of us continue to appreciate all the things that the ocean has to offer. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for coming here. It's been really fun. Thank you.
That was Nigella Hillgarth, president and CEO of the New England Aquarium, and my frequent distraction there, those silent cameos by Myrtle the sea turtle. That's it for this Friday edition of Radio Boston. Have a great weekend. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.